Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
4, 3, 2, 1. And we are live with Dr. Christopher Earnshaw, who is one of the world's leading scholars of alchemy, hermetic philosophy, and Freemasonry. Drawing on his extensive academic background and decades of research, we're going to explore the history, symbolism, and deeper spiritual traditions behind these timeless subjects, offering insights rarely discussed in mainstream conversations. Huge thank you for coming on, Chris. And the first thing I would like to ask is, what put all of this onto your radar?
So I have a long history of masonry through my family. My father, grandfather, and I believe my great-grandfather were all Masons in England. And so, yes, it's always been of interest to me.
I see. So it's you've got the Masonic DNA in the family.
I think so. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
All right. And you've sent us a presentation, so I'm going to put that on the screen now. Here we go. Spiritual alchemy and Freemasonry. And when we hear the word alchemy, we do, of course, think of these ancient people trying to convert things into gold. Is that a cliche? Is there far more to it than that?
There is more to it than that. It's actually slightly complicated, but I'll try and make it easier to understand for your audience.
Yes, please. So how would you define it?
It is a precursor to chemistry. And in fact, we get the word chemistry from alchemy, alchemy. So it was a simple person's understanding of what chemistry is.
Okay, so let us...
And from alchemy, we got so many things like dyes for fabrics and perfumes, and all sorts of byproducts were invented, but not gold.
Okay, yeah, they're still trying to figure that one out. How do we get to the next page then in the presentation?
Click. Okay. <There we go. laughs> So... The practitioners in the old days were very religious. And so that's an important point. It wasn't just people trying to make gold. They thought they were doing God's work. They were speeding up nature in one way of thinking. The word alchemy is actually Egyptian, and it means black earth. And it refers to the fertile earth either side of the Nile, because the Nile floods every year and it brings silt down from Upper Egypt into Lower Egypt. And if this rich earth didn't come, then the country wouldn't be able to grow its crops and there would be famine. And that's what happened many times in ancient Egypt. So in this picture, which dates from 1590, I believe, it shows a large room. And alchemy was very expensive, so it tended to be done by rich people. And obviously, this is a rich person's house. On the left side, he is praying at an altar. And in the middle, there is a table with lots of including musical instruments, but chemical things. And then on the right-hand side, where there is a curtain, there would be a furnace. So the alchemist would walk from one to the other, praying and mixing and doing his work. And they were also very secretive. For several reasons. First of all, if they discovered how to make gold, it would make them very rich. But it also made them a target for other people to scam them, I suppose. And so when they wrote down their experiments, they used to use symbolism. And in this picture, we have some birds. I think the one on the right, the red one, is a phoenix. And then we have a black swan. And at the top, you have a mixture of a black and white and red bird, a combined bird. There's a queen on the left. She's got a crown. And on the right is a king. So again, this is the idea that this is a very rich person's experiment, I suppose. These books, one of the most famous books is called Mutus Liber, and it's about 15 pages, but with hardly any writing. It's just pictures. And if you were an alchemist, you would probably know what it meant. It's a little bit difficult to understand. Also, they used esoteric or exotic materials. And here's a picture of, in the foreground, there's a man and a woman, and they are squeezing a length of linen to get the liquid out of it. And behind them, they have these sheets which have been prepared to collect dew in the morning. Because early in the morning, the ground gives off liquid, and this dew was collected, and they believed that it had special qualities to it. And you can see in the background the red and white stripes. This is the influence of heaven coming down onto earth, and they believed that this influence had a kind of intelligence to it, and that would be collected in the dew. And this was one of the particular or special ingredients to make the Philosopher's Stone. And this stone, which wasn't a stone, but it was probably more like a catalyst, and this catalyst would be able to convert base metal, such as iron or lead, into gold. And this dew also appears in Freemasonry. However, very few Freemasons recognize that, which is a bit sad. Anyway, that's part of my challenge, is to teach people. To do the experiments, they used difficult furnaces. On the right, there's this furnace, and many times they had triple furnaces. And the triple furnace was based on the Trinity, again, from the connection to doing God's work. And so they would use everything in threes. They needed very high temperatures, often, like, I think iron melts at something like 2,000 degrees centigrade. And to get these very high temperatures, they would use charcoal and coal, but they would force air into these furnaces, either by blowing it or using bellows. And so alchemists became known as puffers. They were puffing air into this furnace. The other thing, important thing about alchemy was that it was a seven-step process. And so from going back over, say, 200-300 years, they had kind of found that the most important parts of alchemy were in seven steps, which was burning, dissolving, separating, joining, fermenting, distillation, and then coagulating. So that was first talked about by Newton, and he translated something known as the Emerald Tablet, and these seven steps were in the Emerald Tablet, which is actually a script, a sort of sacred script. And they also used seven alchemical metals. And this is also in Freemasonry. Again, if somebody's looking for it, they would probably find it. One of the interesting things about science in those days was they still didn't have a complete understanding of how things worked. So they thought that metal was growing underground, and you started off and it just got bigger and it sort of developed. It put out roots, because when people dug up copper or gold, they saw it in veins in the rock, and they thought it was rather like the roots of a tree, that they just, it grew. And so from there, they thought that a simple metal, which they called a base metal, was iron, and then it grew from iron into tin, and then grew into copper, into lead, mercury, then into silver, and finally into gold. And they felt that their job was to hurry the process along and use copper or lead, and then somehow with pressure and mixing and whatever, make it into gold. And it was a really expensive process, because you needed all these different metals. And so it became, as I showed at the beginning, the big room. It was practiced by rich people, including kings and popes of the Catholic Church. And so it had a moniker. It was known as the Royal Art. And in Freemasonry, the word Royal Art comes up a lot. In modern times, what is interesting is that people have still tried to make lead into gold. One of the problems is that lead is made up of 82 protons, while gold is made up of 79. And to get rid of three protons takes a lot of energy. They use something called nuclear transmutation, and it uses so much energy that the cost of the energy far exceeds the amount of gold that you will make. However, it was has been successfully done in 1951 by the Nobel laureate, Glenn Seaborg. He's an American physicist. So it is possible, but people are not doing it. It's rather like making diamonds, which is actually easier now than it used to be, but similar process. So that's the background to what alchemy is. If I now look at the objective of alchemy, and alchemy's objectives changed over time. There are basically four types of alchemy, and the first one started around 500 BC in China. So we're talking 2,500 years ago. And it was an elixir, something you could drink, and they called it the elixir of immortality. So the first Chinese emperors, they had this wish that they could live forever. I mean, everybody does, but not many people have the resources to do experimentation. So the emperor set up a department of alchemy, with a chief alchemist and several, rather like a laboratory, and many under alchemists. And he sent these alchemists all around China, collecting samples from samples that could be used, and getting stories from local healers about people who've lived a long time, etc. Well, I think you know that China is about the same size as Europe, which is 10 million square kilometers. So it's a very large place. But after a couple of hundred years, having focused on mercury, for them, mercury was a very unique product because it's a liquid metal. It's the only liquid metal. It's made from cinnabar. And they thought that this had some unique properties, and they weren't sure what they were. Eventually, they settled on three prime materials, mercury, sulfur, and magnesium. And all of these are very dangerous in their own ways. Mercury, when heated, gives off fumes, which are poisonous. And it was said that perhaps Isaac Newton died prematurely because he had been working heating mercury. Magnesium and sulfur, of course, explode. So it's all very dangerous. Anyway, they made these concoctions and they had to produce something for the emperor. And they tried them out on convicted prisoners. And so they said, well, if you drink this and you live, we will spare you your life. However, nobody survived. Oh. And even so, 9 emperors tried the concoctions, whatever was available when they're about to die. And 9 emperors also died. So mercury is a very dangerous product.
Yeah, so do you remember the mercury thermometers? And they said if you ever break a mercury thermometer, they had very specific instructions how to deal with it.
Yes, it is dangerous, yes. There's not much mercury in a thermometer, though, so I think that's we don't have to worry about that now. So about 100 BC, a new emperor came, and they realized that the chemistry wasn't working. And so instead of making a physical product, they decided what was necessary was a spiritual transformation. And at the time, Taoism, going back to also 2000 BC, it was the national religion. There was no Buddhism, there's nothing. It was Taoism. And Taoism, there were different types of Taoism for the nobility, the emperor, and the general people. And then it was shamanistic Taoism. But anyway, so they practiced this technique. And what they found was that they could leave their body in something known as astral travel. And they learnt this technique. They wrote it down on a scroll, and the scroll is known as the Secret of the Golden Flower. This scroll was, in those days, there wasn't really block printing. I think it might have been invented, but they weren't using it. They tended to borrow scrolls and then write it out by hand, and then pass the scroll on to somebody else. And in fact, in the 16, 1700s, Newton was doing the same thing when he got a very valuable alchemical book. As there was only one of them, he would write the whole book out by hand. Anyway, so where are we now? So we got here, and that is all explained. The alchemy bit is explained in this book on spiritual alchemy. I use 3 of my texts to write this presentation. These are the 3 emperors who were particularly interested in making the elixir of immortality. But there were many more over the years. And so China was trading at that time. China's a red line. It's not very good, but they traded with India. And the Indians traded with the Arabs. And so this secret idea about alchemy ended up in Arabia, this Arabia, including Egypt. And Arabs were very advanced in mathematics, also astronomy and metallurgy. And so they studied these ideas about alchemy. And from here, what happened, it's about now 1000 AD, is the time of the Crusades. And the Templars learnt about alchemy. And through the Templars, it also started to go back to Europe. A lot of the Templars, people misunderstand the Templars. First of all, they were priests. They were part of the Holy Order for the Temple of Jerusalem, but they were also soldiers. And they protected people who were trying to make the journey from Europe to Jerusalem, the pilgrimage. So, and they protected them, and then they lent them money, and they started a banking system. And from the banking system, they had a trading system, and they had many ships going around Europe. So they were a source of knowledge. So the other thing is that many of them were born in the Levant, and the Levant includes all the far coast of we would now call it Palestine, Lebanon, and all down to I suppose as far as Egypt was all Levant, and they were born there. So their first language was Arabic, and their second language was English, and the third language would have been Latin, because they were priests. Anyway, so they learnt this language, and the next step was, this is a picture of El Cid. You might have seen the film. When I was a kid, the picture El Cid and Lawrence of Arabia, these epics were very popular in England at the time. But he was part of the Spanish resistance to the Moors. The Moors were a subgroup of Arabs who lived in northern Africa, and mainly from Morocco, Tunis, Libya, that area. And they invaded Spain in 711 AD. And they brought this technology of alchemy with them into Spain. And so the Spanish were persecuted, but they got to learn to live with the Arabs. And with the Arabs, Jews who'd lived in harmony with Arabs for many centuries, they also moved into Spain. And I believe that they used alchemical technology to learn how to make glass, because they used sand, which is basically silica, and they learned this technology of congealing and separation and dividing, and learned to make glass from it. But they were also learning how to make gold. And so they were there 800 years. And then the next slide will show you is a drawing what the final days of the Moorish invasion of Spain looked like. This is 1492. American viewers will remember this is when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But it's also the year of the Reconquista, when King Ferdinand II and Isabella I raised armies and were able to get the Moors to go back to Africa. And the Moors had somewhere to go to, because they come from their own countries, even though it was 800 year gap. But the Jews were kind of a wandering tribe, and they were forced into Europe, and they brought this idea of alchemy into Europe. So far we've had two types of alchemy. We talked about the elixir of immortality, which turned into a spiritual exercise. And then we have the making of gold. And now we have the third type of alchemy, which was by monks and friars who used the same techniques to make medicine. And so monks and friars were famous because of their hospitality rule, that they had to give people who were traveling or visiting the area, they had to give hospitality to these people, a room to stay and something to eat, I suppose. And they also were making medicine and healing people, etc. They were also very famous for their tonics, which was a type of medicine in those days. And here's two of them. So you have on the left Benedictine, which, and both of these are still popular nowadays. in my house, we only drink them at Christmas. Otherwise, we just keep them at the back of the cabinet. But anyway, we bring them out once a year. And so Benedictine was made by the Benedictine monks and Chartreuse by the Chartreuse monks. So, yes. And if you go to their website, you will see that there are hundreds of herbs used in the concoction. But again, this is a very secret, for this was their IP, their intellectual property, and it was special to that group of, and I'm only showing two, but there's probably a dozen of these different types of drinks. What happened next was in the early 1600s came Rosicrucianism, and Rosicrucianism was a kind of short-lived, probably about 40 years, 50 years. People were writing books about it, but there was no organization. It came secretly. They were putting posters up on walls in Paris, and then people got very excited, and they were claiming that they had the secret to making gold, etc. Again, within the Rosicrucianism, there's a person called Paracelsus, and he used, again, alchemy to make medicine. And so that became very popular. So the next step was a very large step. And what we have here is just a group of pictures. In 1660, which coincides with the start of the Royal Society in England, this is important because the Royal Society decided to organize what was known as natural philosophy, and that was a blanket term for anything to do with research. So they decided to look at research of bodies, and they called it biology, looking at research of metal as metallurgy, and then chemistry and geology, geometry, etc. So, and then these Royal Societies of Chemistry, Royal Society of Physics, etc., were established. And so because chemistry became an organized subject, alchemy started to die out, and everybody said it was a nonsense thing. You're not going to succeed. Nobody's ever succeeded with alchemy. And so they started focusing on how to make dyes for fabric and how to make flavoring and all sorts of other things in rubber, and rubber coating for clothes and rubber coating for boots, like Wellington boots. Anyway, so at the same time in 1660, tea was imported into Europe, and it became particularly popular in England. And what is interesting is that it was actually green tea that the English were drinking, not what we drink now. We call it Ceylon tea, or in the Far East, we call it red tea. But in England, they were drinking green tea because red tea hadn't been invented by then. And so with it, what happened is that there was a lot of trade with China. They brought the tea, then they brought silk, and then they brought teacups. And the teacups was very important. It wasn't just teacups, but plates and chinaware. And chinaware became very sought after by the aristocracy. For the importers, it was very important because chinaware is very heavy. They packed it into wooden barrels, and they used it as ballast for the ships, so the ships don't turn over in bad weather. So it served two purposes. It was like a byproduct. They were bringing upper decks. They had silk and other things like furniture and clothes and other things, and tea, of course. And down in the lower decks, they had ballast, and it was the teacups. So it all went together well. They had teacups and something to put in the teacups. And this picture shows, for example, near St. Petersburg in Russia, on the top left, there's actually a Chinese village has been constructed and all the houses are Chinese style and there's a pagoda there. The bottom left, the furniture was very tended to be black, but it had Chinese pictures painted on it. And this became a style that was very sought after in Europe, known as chinoiserie. The top right is the House of Confucius that was built in, I think it was in Hyde Park, and it was, it wasn't Hyde Park, Kew Park. Yes, in Kew Park. And below it, there was a 10-story pagoda that was not only built in London, but it's still there. I don't know if anyone's been to Kew Gardens. Look it up on the internet. But the 10-story pagoda was just being refurbished with government money. It looks splendid. It's been there over 300 and something years. Quite surprising.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So furniture. And then besides small things, we had wallpaper, which was hand painted in China. And then we had gardens. And my family house, our garden is divided into sections. We have an orchard and then we have lawns. And below the lawns, we have somewhere we used to call the dell. And that was a Chinese garden. And I only realized that like 2 years ago while I was writing this book. Oh, that sounds like my garden. And what was unique about it, it had lots of small, probably how big, 3 or 4 times the size of a bath, very small little lakes, and they trickle down into another lake and it just goes down the hill like that. And around we had bamboo, and we had 3 types of bamboo. Sasa, which is a thin grass-like bamboo, very thin, thinner than a pencil. And then we had normal bamboo. And then we had black bamboo. And as a child, I just never thought anything of it. I see it all the time. And among that, they had at various points, they had these orchids that have been planted in 2 and 3. It wasn't a row of them. It's just one at a certain auspicious point, you know, and it goes down and there was another one. I mean, thinking about it, it was quite a big deal. Anyway, so people were making gardens, and I lived in Guildford, you know, and so this is how far. So all over the country, people were doing these things. There are houses in Hampstead in London. There's one Chinese one, and it's still there. It's got Chinese roof, and the name's changed. But
I lived in Guildford for over 10 years.
Oh, right. So I was outside, was near Shamley Green.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Gorgeous out there. Yeah. All the gardens, countryside.
The Bricklayer's Arm. And then further along was Cranley School, where my grandfather went. And we lived in up the hill there.
Yeah, I used to be a regular guest speaker at Cranley.
Mm. Cool. Yeah. It's... Small world. and what's also interesting is if you look around London, there are many examples of Chinese things left over that have been there years. For example, in Buckingham Palace, they've just opened a new section, which I'd really like to see, but it's full of Chinese. I mean, we're talking about several hundred year old Chinese ceramics, very, very valuable. And they've just opened it to the public. Carlton House, Brighton Pavilion, they're full of Chinese things because people were importing and collecting. And anyway, so what happened then was this is a picture of a Chinese house. It's actually part of an organization called Tian Di Hui. I was going to include it here, but I thought the conversation would be too broad, so I left it out. but it's part of the Taoist conversation. Anyway, let's move on. So 16, this is a picture of Lord McCartney on the first diplomatic mission to China. And so considering all the trade we were doing, you'd have thought the government would have sent someone earlier. Anyway, this is typical English story. The trade mission failed because Lord McCartney refused to bow to the Emperor of China. Oh. Yeah, well, this is a guy, you know, with 100,000 people, soldiers, and you're a guest. And anyway, the Emperor of China, Qianlong. And so it didn't go well. And there was a second one. And for the same reason, the second one also failed. I mean, just people don't... Anyway, so then... what happened was, this is a interesting picture. I don't have the colour one, shame. This is a picture of the Prince of Wales. It's at the end of 1700s. It's a lot of things are hidden in this picture. Very interesting, but he is shown with Chinese on the right and left side. People wearing gowns and Chinese style hats. And, but in fact, I don't really think he had Chinese servants. I think perhaps sometimes they dressed up. He is shown here with, on the left side of the picture, Fitzherbert. I forget her first name. Anyway, that was his mistress. And on the right was his daughter. And he was at the time was the Prince of Wales, and he was in hot water with Parliament. He later, at the time, he was also the Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of England. He weighed something like 14 stone. And anyway, he did like his food. He became King George the Fourth. I think 1812, something like that. Next picture is 1839. This is the first Opium War, and after the Opium War, China lost. The Opium War is a disgraceful thing when you think about it, because the British were growing opium in India to subvert the Chinese population by getting them high all the time and selling opium cheaply in China. But they wouldn't sell opium in England or anywhere else, only in China. Qianlong wouldn't have it, and then he closed the country to trade. And so all the silks and tea and stuff, we no longer got it in England. So what's an interesting development in England, because when we look at Freemasonry, I like to look at the social history of what was going on at the time. And this is a picture, in fact, it's not the correct picture. I couldn't find the right one. This is a picture of King James the First book about sports. He was encouraging people to take up archery and fencing and riding and all sorts of things. But he said it should be done on a Sunday. And the church didn't agree, and they burnt all his books. And the person doing the burning is the hangman. They got another name for it. Yeah, the hangman. And so he was a public executioner, and that's his job, to burn books. Anyway, so in 1702, this Dr. William Coward said that the soul did not exist. He just couldn't understand the concept of a soul. When the body dies, the soul dies. And this was seen as blasphemy in England. But they didn't really have a good idea of what blasphemy was in legal terms. The church had its own ideas, but the church wasn't running the government. So the government had introduced a blasphemy law in 1697. So this is just 5 years later after the law was introduced, and it seemed like it was challenging the law. So Parliament debated whether this book was blasphemy or not. It was found to be blasphemy. All his books were burnt in public, which made his book even more popular because everybody wanted to know what was so bad about this book. And he sold even more of the book. So it didn't really work. It's rather like prostitution and other things, not easy to organize. Anyway, so what happened was over the coming years, the subject of immortality and the soul became a major controversy in England. And many people, probably a dozen people, were writing books and pamphlets and things about the subject. And even educated people, philosophers, were putting their oar in. And so what then happened was very interesting. I mean, the timing was perfect. This Chinese Mandarin, his name is Shen Fuzhong. He arrived in 1687. So just when was it? Yes, just before the blasphemy law was introduced. And this is the first time a Chinese person had been in England. There had been deckhands on ships who were coolies, what we call coolies, and the word coolie means arduous power, you know, so it was a very arduous job. There'd been coolies, but this is a Mandarin. A Mandarin is a senior official in the Chinese government at the time, and even now we use the word Mandarin to refer to ministers in the British government. They call them Mandarins. Anyway, so this Mandarin came, and he came with servants. And when he arrived, he was met by some, I believe, by some Jesuit priests, because he had a connection with Jesuits. And he had an audience with King James II. And King James II liked this person very much. And interestingly, because he had a very strong relationship with the Jesuits, and in fact, he wanted to be a Jesuit, he knew Latin quite well. And so educated people in England all spoke Latin. And because the church services were in Latin, and it was just taught Latin and Greek. If you were really educated, like Thomas Hyde, you would speak, he spoke Arabic and Hebrew, Latin, Greek, and I think Persian. I mean, that was really, but anyway, so Mandarin Shen Fuzhong didn't have difficulty communicating with educated people. Anyway, so this painting was done by Godfrey Kneller. It's called The Chinese Convert, because he was thinking of converting to Catholicism. And it's in the Queen's collection at Windsor Castle. It's a large painting, I believe. So he met somebody called Thomas Hyde. I'll show a picture in a moment. And what we were talking about previously, about the Chinese search for elixir of immortality becoming a spiritual exercise, which was written down in The Secret of the Golden Flower, I believe he brought a copy with him. Just as he left China, the book, the scroll had been published as a book. And so he probably either bought the book or wanted the book. And then when he came to England, he decided to give it to a like-minded individual, and he was introduced, and this is the book now, Secret of the Golden Flower. It's quite complicated and quite difficult to read, but anyway, it talks about how to have an out-of-body experience, what we call astral travel. And why this is important is because if you leave your body, you know that you are immortal. That's it. I mean, and they were talking about immortality and did it exist and does the soul exist and whatever. But this Chinese is Mandarin. He had the answer. Here's the book. I can show you how to do it. And so I believe this is Thomas Hyde. Shen spent nearly 1 year at Oxford University. Hyde was the senior librarian at the Bodleian Library at Oxford University. Not only that, he was the court interpreter because he spoke five languages, and he interpreted for the court and the king. And so there's the connection. So Shen gave him the thing, and you can see in his right hand he's holding a scroll. And the scroll, if you look at it, and I've looked at it very large, I haven't seen the original, but if you expand the picture, it says stories of gold from my hometown. And I think, okay. So why is a, and he wasn't just a librarian, he was a professor of Arabic and Hebrew. They didn't teach Chinese at Oxford, and nobody was interested in Chinese, which is a little bit strange, but anyway. But why is he holding a Chinese scroll about gold? Anyway, I think that's what was given to him by Shen. And so what next picture is, oh, so this story, Initiation by Light, tells you all about this connection, the chain of communication. What is it? Anyway, how the story got from one person to another, and chain of transmission. Sorry. Yes, and the background to the Chinese, and there were a lot of in Victorian times. There were after the opium wars had settled down, and then China was open to trade again. Britain sent some consuls and ambassadors to China, and these were all what we call China Hans. They spoke not just Mandarin, but they spoke Fujian and other language, other dialects. And they saw that there was a form of Freemasonry, and this is 1800s, so Freemasonry had already been had a 100-year history. They thought that this was the origin of, they thought that China was the origin of Freemasonry, and they wrote about it in several books, and I talk about it in my books. Anyway, on to the next slide. So Oxford was a breeding ground for, let's see, yes, So in the time from about 1700 to 1800, Oxford had many alchemists living and working there, and includes people like Kenelm Digby, George Starkey, who is an American, and Elias Ashmole, who established the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford. And these people, they studied alchemy, they had texts, they bought texts in Europe, and they were translating them. Anyway, so what happened next was, so Freemasonry was started in 1717. So I believe that the three founders of Freemasonry, and which include George Payne and de Sagulier, George Payne and de Sagulier worked for Newton, and George Payne George Payne worked at the Mint in London, while Newton worked at the Treasury, and the Treasury and the Mint were in the same building. And the Mint, of course, they were making public stamping coins, and also trying to stop counterfeiting, what they called clipping, counterfeiting of coins. And so George Payne and Newton, and Newton was a dedicated alchemist, and he had his own furnaces and things. And so he might have met, probably knew each other, and may have told or talked about what he had heard from Shen. And Newton's secretary at the Royal Society was John de Sagulier, who was the third Grand Master. And so this connection is just too strange, too impossible that they didn't hear about it and they didn't talk about it. But Newton didn't want to be involved in Freemasonry because he was Dean of Cambridge University and later of Oxford University. He was a very famous, of course, he was the president of the Royal Society, and he didn't know if Freemasonry was going to be successful, or was it going to be stamped out by the government, or what was going to happen. So he lent some ideas, but he didn't lend his name. Let's put it that way. So what I think is that they'd heard about this Taoist idea of astral travel at a time when everybody was talking about immortality and the existence of the soul after death. And they thought, well, let's do it. Let's see if we can do it ourselves. And that's why they set up the organization. But they wanted to make these teachings secret, but at the same time, to introduce them to a wider audience, particularly a few select aristocrats. It wasn't open to the general public, put it that way. And so this is an alchemical painting. It's from the what was it called? Hermeticus. Yes, Hermeticus. I forget. And if you know what you're looking at, there are several Masonic symbols in there, in this picture, which is an alchemical picture, but it is also applies to Freemasonry. From here, what we started having is people started writing books about Freemasonry as exposés. And sometimes there was a mixture of truth. There were some lies. There was all mixed. It was a bit murky. But anyway, people were making money selling these type of books. And Freemasonry became so popular. We had within 50 years, we probably had 200 lodges. By 1813, which is 100, there were over 1,000 lodges. And most of them were in London and the greater London area, which would be Surrey, Sussex, Kent, that sort of area. A few in the north of England, but mostly in the south. And so because it became so popular, there were two things. One, people wanted to know what the secrets of Freemasonry were. But secondly, it was a way to make money because you would collect fees and you'd have events like banquets. So you would collect money. And so some unscrupulous people abused the lodges to make money for them. It's like what happens with crypto and yes, somebody I will not mention. This here is a picture of an organization which he called the Chinese Order of the Gormagons. And it was set up by the fifth Grand Master of Freemasonry called the Duke of Wharton. And he was a very shady character. Anyway, so what it is that the four Grand Masters are in this picture on the right-hand side. One's on the donkey, one's got his head in the ladder. And in front of them are four Asian-looking people. So what they're trying to say is that these Asian people are leading Freemasonry. That's what I believe it says. And then the next slide is a detail of those four people. The third one, and the letters, the name's got little letters above their heads. So we know, and there's an index at the bottom. So we know that number three is meant to be Confucius. And the first one has a sun and the letter for cinnabar under his, and that in Chinese, the character for sun and cinnabar means the philosopher's stone. How these people knew this level of Chinese is quite interesting. Anyway, the second person is a Westerner and is probably meant to be the Duke of Wharton. So here is a picture of what the book talks about. It's complicated, but one important thing is to join the masculine energies and the female energies together. And so you're not over masculine, you're not over feminine. And so this is a problem we see in society now, that a lot of men try to be over masculine force their opinions and their volition on other people. Some men tend to be slightly feminine, and it works for females as well. Females, we use the term butch, but you know, they tend to be over masculine. So it should be a middle road, that you are you can be a man but sensitive to women's needs and thinking and whatever. You don't have to wear pink shirts to show that you understand how women feel. It's this mixture. It's what it's one of the teachings of the Secret of the Golden Flower. And then they show the last picture. It shows the above the man sitting down his head. It looks like a little squiggle, but there's another person above the squiggle. And basically that is his spirit leaving his body in an out-of-body experiment. Anyway, yes. So what's really interesting for me is that alchemy has, because of Freemasonry, it has come full circle in this search for immortality. It started off trying to get the elixir of immortality, and then it got taken down one road to making gold and another go for making medicine and alcohol, and now it's come back full circle in that Freemasonry is kind of the the teaching people how to understand immortality. And I don't have a picture, I should have found it somewhere, but this is the kind of the last slide. But about 1730-35, so the Grand Lodge of England had been established, a Swedish engineer known as Emanuel Swedenborg, he joined a lodge in London. He'd actually joined it before. It's complicated. There were different types of organizations until Freemasonry got established. There were St. John's lodges and there were lodges of the ancients, etc. But anyway, Swedenborg was a Freemason, and about 1740 something, he decided that he no longer wanted to work at all. He wanted to study spirituality, and he started exercising. I don't know if he read The Secret of the Golden Flower, but I think he was influenced by what he heard in Freemasonry, and he started having out-of-body experiences, and he wrote them down in his book, Heaven and Hell, which was published in 1756. So that shows the kind of connection, I think, there between spirituality and out-of-body experiences and Freemasonry and Swedenborg and things. So basically, this is my theory. And if you have any questions, please ask.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here. And if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Absolutely. My first question is, Dr. Christopher Earnshaw, do you have any more wonderful presentations like this? Because that was riveting.
Oh, thank you. Yes, so I have different ones for different audiences. Yes, I have lots of them.
What subjects?
Well, I could open them up now and find out. I'm not quite sure what's up. Let's have a look. Pictures, podcasts. Most of them are this type of esoteric. Here we are. In Freemasonry, there are degrees, and then there are higher degrees, and one of them is called the Royal Arch. And so we'll talk about that. Then I talk about the class structure and the schism between the lodges in the early days, the problem of Euclid. It's a Masonic problem. Let's see, Masonic tarot cards. I'm a tarot master, so I design my own tarot cards, but there is actually a Masonic tarot card. There's Freemasonry and the Kabbalah. There's a problem with class structure and Freemasonry, and a little bit, you know, boring. They're mainly things that would interest Masons.
Well, they're certainly interested to the viewers. Viewers, put a one in the chat if you'd like Dr. Christopher Earnshaw to come back and do another presentation at some point. If you've got any questions, put them in the chat. I think many people are curious. When did the royal family, the UK royal family, become so steeped in Freemasonry?
Yes. So what happened was originally it was just aristocrats. The first was the Duke of Montague. And I think that was probably 1721 or so. And following him, he had a few personal problems, so he stepped down. Then the next one was the Duke of Wharton, who was a problem. He had all the wrong credentials. He elected himself as Grand Master. He lasted 6 months. And then I think the first member of the royal family was the Duke of Connaught. I might even have a note about it. The Duke of Connaught. No, I don't. The Prince of Wales. So, yes. Then after the Duke of Connaught was the Prince of Wales, who became King George IV in 1813. Then most of the royal family were Masons, and the only one that kind of stands out was Prince Albert, the consort to Queen Victoria. He was not interested in Freemasonry at all, and he said so quite directly. Following him, then I think George V, George VI were. Now the present royal family, King Charles, Prince Harry, and Prince William are not Freemasons. But I think Charles's cousin, or is it Elizabeth's cousin, the Duke of Kent, is actually the head of Freemasonry in present time. So we've had about 15 members of the royal family as Grand Masters.
Is it true that Queen Elizabeth insisted that Charles not become a Freemason?
I don't know. I haven't heard that. No, it's difficult. It's a little bit difficult in for the royal family. They have a certain outward presentation. You know, they're not private people as such. And so I think that may be true. Yes. Yes.
Okay. So Mackley's asking, can anyone join the Freemasons, or do you have to have something to offer, e.g., a powerful position? And do they preclude women still, or as though female branches?
Yes. So this is actually quite interesting. I believe this is based on Taoism, because in Taoism, it originally was a male only religion. females could not attend. And it was part of the court. And in the court, there were no women. Women had lesser roles, like courtesans and other making tea. The officials were all men, and it was their religion for the court. And so in China, the Taoist rituals were all done by men. Nowadays, modern Taoism, women are allowed to attend, but the women sit on the left side and men sit on the right side. In Freemasonry and in Taoism, the left is meant to signify the weaker side of the body and the right is the stronger side. That's a bit sexist, but that's the way it is. So about joining Freemasonry, anybody can apply to join Freemasonry. What we want are people who are going to contribute to Freemasonry. We call it the craft of Freemasonry. We want people to contribute to the craft and to be, rather than taking from us or just be freeloaders and just wandering along and seeing what goes on. We want people to get involved. And Freemasonry is a charity. We do a lot of charitable work and we want people to help us with our work. So, you don't have to be, you don't have to have anything to offer Freemasonry. I think you need to be able to offer free time, which is quite valuable nowadays, but you don't have to be the chief executive of a major organization, or you don't have to be very rich, or you don't have to have a high education. None of those things matter. We want good people so how we define good is difficult, but you also have to be God-fearing. So you have to believe in a higher authority. So we believe we are not a Christian organization per se. Originally we were, but we have opened our intake of brethren to include other religions besides Christianity. And but we believe that we will ask people to take, so we have secrets that we keep to ourselves, and they're not anything that the CIA would be or the FBI would be interested in, but we call them secrets, and we want you to keep those secrets as though they were your own secrets. And if you take an oath, we want to make sure you will keep that oath. And the only way we can make sure you'll keep that oath is if you make the oath in a higher authority's name, like God or some higher authority. And so in his name, I make this oath. And so if you break the oath, the retribution will come from him, not from the Masons. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yes.
Marie says you've talked about the Chinese influence. Yes. Did the Egyptians have influence on Freemasonry?
So, yes, what happened in England was that England went through three phases, major phases. The first phase was this Chinese, and went on for about 120 or 30 years, where Chinese were so involved or part of English society. And I saw just the other day, I was watching a detective story on television, and I forget what it was. What was it called? It's about a Catholic priest who's a detective. And Goodfellow. Anyway, so she was wearing a small Chinese hat, you know, and that was in the 1900s. But anyway, so these things were still around in society. So after the Opium Wars and the close of trade with China, what happened at exactly the same time is that there was this Napoleonic expedition to Egypt. And I'm not sure why he went there, because there was nothing much there. The population had all disappeared. The pyramid was there. The Sphinx was up to the top of its head. It was covered in sand. So one of the first things he did was to dig out the Sphinx because he didn't know what it was. So they wandered around Egypt, taking drawings. There was no photography, so they're drawing things. And they found all these hieroglyphs. And of course, nobody knew how to read it. They brought the samples back to France, and then an Egyptian scholar called Champollion. I missed out a bit. They found this stone in Egypt, which had three languages on. One was Greek, and then hieroglyphs, Greek and Assyrian, perhaps. Anyway, so this Rosetta Stone was taken back, and he was able then to transliterate, and then they were able to understand what was written on the walls of the pyramids and Sphinx and whatever. And so because of that, there was this great period of interest in Egypt. And many people were writing saying, yes, but the story of... Because there's a misunderstanding. They had a superficial understanding of Egypt because they studied, but they hadn't studied all the Egyptian texts, and they hadn't studied for years and years. They just found some samples and they translate, and they believe that Egypt was a religion of death, death worship. And so they got it all upside down. And then they associated Freemasonry with Egypt, and that Freemasonry was concerned with death. We're not, but there is a part of Freemasonry where somebody dies. But so they were kind of making these strange allusions between the two where there was no truth at all. And that went on for another 50 years until about 1850, and I don't have the actual, I should have the date down here, shouldn't I? Queen Victoria, she became queen in 1837, and then soon after she became the Empress of India. And because of that, everyone flocked to India, and suddenly India was the flavor of the week. Everyone forgot China and Egypt, and it's all India now. And so that's how society goes. And so Queen Victoria became an influencer, I suppose. And so the thing about Egypt is there is no real connection with Freemasonry and Egypt. It's very superficial. But people still make those connections. And so I'm trying to I keep forgetting my English because I speak Japanese all the time and I forget English. Put the history straight. Is that right? Put the story straight that it was China that influenced Freemasonry and not all the other. Yeah. Sorry.
It's been absolutely fascinating. We've run out of time. There's endless questions, so we'd love to get you back. We've got all your links in the description box. You've got your channel. We've got your books, your website.
Oh, so very kind.
Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion to the viewers?
I forgot to mention that women are welcome in Freemasonry. We have a organization for women Freemasons. There are actually two, HFAF, HAFAF, I think. In America, there are more organizations open for women. So this is a worldwide organization, over 5 million members. And, I didn't tell you, have we got 2 minutes?
Yes, go for it.
Okay. So I first discovered this in 2016. I didn't know anything about this Chinese connection. In years past, I was at London University. I studied Chinese and Japanese, and I studied Mencius. And I met a professor from Taiwan, and we were talking about Mencius, and he invited me to Taiwan. And I spent a week or 10 days in a Taoist temple, and I saw an initiation happening there. And I thought, this is the same as Freemasonry. And I was so surprised. Everything was exactly the same as Freemasonry. And I thought, why? Why? So then I started studying, and then... Taoism has been without change. The same rituals have been going on in Taoism for 3,000 years. Freemasonry only has 300-year history. Well, only. So that started me thinking. And then I found the connection to Shen Fu Zhong, and the whole thing opened up. Anyway.
All right. Well, huge thank you for coming on. I'm going to let you get on with your day. Have a great rest of your day over there in Surrey.
Thanks, Sean.
And you take care. Cheers.
Thank you very much. Great thank seeing you. You.
Absolutely fascinating. I love it when we take a journey through history over the centuries, all the different schools of philosophy and how these thoughts have shaped where we are in the modern day, how it all intertwines and links over the ages. So, yeah, that was riveting. So well researched. Love the presentation. Love the voice. And many people said loving the voice. So I'm back tomorrow with Micah Turnbow. We're going to be talking about modern day Satanism. So this is Saturday night, 8 p.m., August 1st. Spiritual warfare, angels, demons, modern Satanism. And Ron is coming up next. He's got his daily show at 2 p.m. today. And then tonight we have got The Hidden Economy, What They Don't Want You to Know with Carl Denninger. So two more shows coming up today, folks. If you're watching on replay, all of Dr. Christopher Earnshaw's links are in the description box. So please check out and support his work. He's got his X down there as well. So if you've got any more questions, maybe you can direct.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.